last thing we want to talk about, actually two things we want to talk about tonight. And then we'll finish up this class, this series on Lessons from the Christian Past, and hopefully we'll get an opportunity where we can kind of turn around and go through a few questions that I placed on the PowerPoint to kind of help us dialogue about what we learned from this, what is the value, and get specific about it, okay? That's been the whole point. It's not necessarily just to kind of know some interesting facts from the past. We want to actually glean something that can help us for the present from this stuff, and I'm hoping that there have been some recurring themes that have popped up that have made some things come into your mind, and we want to dialogue about that some tonight. But first, we have to finish up with the final Reformation of the period, and that is what is known as the Catholic Counter-Reformation. Now, it used to be that we talked about the Counter-Reformation. That was what it was referred to in the older textbooks, but that's kind of out of date now, because, well, it seems very anti-Catholic, right? And so the Catholics never liked that phrase, Counter-Reformation, because then it makes it seem like the only thing going on in Catholicism in the 16th century was to be opposed to the Protestants. So the Catholics never liked that phrase. And then some Protestants thought, well, yeah, we probably shouldn't call it that. That's being a little bit too anti-Catholic. But let's call it the Catholic Reformation. And then that one kind of went out, because then it was like, well, then you're using terminology from the Protestants to define what we were doing in the 16th century. So now what they're calling it is early modern Catholicism. Okay? So just so you know about it, maybe you don't care. But I still think it's a counter-reformation. It's clearly what they were doing, right? Especially when you look at the Council of Trent, it's like the Protestants say this, we say that. If the Protestants say this, we say that on just about every issue. So I think it's fair to say counter-reformation, even though there may be some points at which they were doing something on their own. But most of it was against the Protestants. There are two things I want to mention in the Catholics, what they will do in the 16th century. It takes them a while to respond to the Protestants. And I think I mentioned this last week, that you had a series of popes that kept dying. You know, they would make it a few years. And then there were some political things involved. 1527, King Charles, Henry, the Holy Roman Emperor, marched down to Rome and sacked the city of Rome. The Pope himself was taken hostage for a little while. German troops run amok in Rome and do some really horrible things, I mean scandalous things, in that sack of Rome in 1527. And so the papacy is really in trouble, and they were the ones that were kind of looked to as the ones who would lead the reform. And eventually the popes will call a council to try to do reform, but one of the main ways that there will be some reform is through a bunch of new orders, religious orders, but the most famous of them is the Jesuits. Okay, this guy up here on the left, Ignatius of Loyola, founded a new monastic order known as the Society of Jesus, or better known as the Jesuits. Okay, we call them Jesuits, and he founded this order. Ignatius has a really interesting story. He was actually, he was a soldier in one of the many wars in Spain and Italy of the time, and he was wounded in the leg. Big balls went through his leg, and it looked like he was going to die. But he was in a long convalescence, and while he was in that convalescence, he had some. I think it was some nuns or the nurses reading to him from the saints' lives. And he got inspired by the lives of the great saints who had gone before. And for lack of a better terminology, he got religion. Okay, and he decided to devote himself to the church, devote himself to serving the Pope. And with all the Protestants running around, it made sense to take his energies against the Protestants. So he actually went back to school, like he was in his 30s or maybe even 40 years old. And he goes back to university and he's actually studying, sitting next to kids that are like 13 years old, studying the same thing. And, you can just imagine. And he became the best student in the class, of course, because he's a serious student, and also he had a mission. And he also gathered around him a group of young guys that were really inspired by what he wanted to do, and these guys would help found the order that is known as the Jesuits. They were founded in 1540, and they would be known as the shock troops of the Counter-Reformation. They would be sent into places to try to convert back the Protestants. Go into Lutheran lands, you might die when you're there, but you know, try to convert the Lutherans back to the church. Sneak into to England after 1534, 35, obviously, because they didn't found until 1540, and they would hold private masses in people's homes when Catholics weren't supposed to do that, and they would, many of them die, you know, because of it and so forth. But they would go to on missions to China. Many Jesuits went to China during this time. They were crucified in Japan. Some of their missions they would go on over there during this time period. But they were really trying to bring the Protestants back. One of the things that they were known for was absolute obedience to the Pope. Some of you may have heard this phrase, but in the main guidebook that the Jesuits used, a thing called the Spiritual Exercises, they had this guidebook that you would go through when you became a Jesuit. One of the things that you had to agree to was absolute submission to the church. And there's actually a phrase that if the church says that black is white and black and white is black, then you agree with the church on that point. Even if it looks black to you, and black, you know, black's black, and the church says it's white, then it's white. And this became one of the hallmarks of the Jesuit order. Also, they were very big into education. You've probably heard of Jesuit High School. There's one up in Portland. There's Georgetown University, founded by Jesuits. Anybody else know any other Jesuit schools? There you go, Loyola University. Okay, they're very known for their education. And one of the phrases that was used in this period of time, the Jesuits would go out and they would found schools all over Europe to try to teach the young people about the Catholic faith. And one of the phrases they used was, "Give me the child, I care not who has the man." Okay? If you'll just give me the children, and their Catholic parent take the children to the Jesuits, they will train them well enough in the faith that when they get old, they can go live amongst a bunch of Protestants and they'll still stay Catholic until the day they die. Okay? And so this becomes one of the hallmarks of the Jesuits. And right in through the modern period, Catholics have been very insistent upon forming Catholic schools and training, and many monks, or Jesuits and nuns would be involved in that education of these parochial schools, right? Anybody go to parochial school? Okay, Bob, parochial school, Don, parochial school. Okay, good. So you've probably experienced that. Any comments?
Glad to be out of it.
Okay, glad to be out of it. All right. Okay. So Catholic finger painting? No? No? Okay. Sorry, that was a bad joke. Okay, so that was one of the main things. And the Jesuits, they go everywhere converting people. Okay, back to the fold. The second, though, is the big point. I know I put a lot of text up there. But that is, there will be a council that is called the Council of Trent. And the popes will eventually call this council. The dates are 1545 to 1563. That's, what is that? 18 years? Okay. Now, they didn't meet the whole time. They met, and then they would meet for like 18 months, and then something would break out. Oh, a war breaks out. Okay, let's stop the council for a while. One pope dies, another one comes together, and he says, let's move it to Bologna. I want it within my papal states. Or they're meeting, and ooh, plague breaks out. Time to cancel the council for a while. So they had all these things that happened. Okay, and so all the different sessions added up to about 18 years. Okay, and they wanted to try to react to the Protestants, but notice the dates. It's really late. It's way too late to really affect a change, okay, that was significant. And no Protestants came to the council, even though they were invited. They didn't come. I mean, by then the lines had been pretty well drawn, and Protestants could remember back previous councils where people like John Huss were invited to come to a council and said, "Hey, no, nothing will ever happen," you know, and then they get burned at the stake. And so they didn't come to those councils. So this was an internal discussion. So, two things. They did do a lot of reform of the moral reform, a lot of the moral problems in the church, you know, priests that had concubines and bishops that had mistresses and so forth. That kind of stuff is swept away. They'll make it so that the bishop goes out and actually visits the congregations in his diocese. Some of them, they've never even been there before. They'll go out and actually ask the priest, interview him, do you know how to say the Mass? Do you know how? It's really kind of do the best they could with cleaning up the some of the abuses. Each diocese after the Council of Trent has to have a seminary where the priests have to be trained in. So you're never going to have this charge against the Catholics where the priest is totally ignorant. He doesn't know how to do anything other than just spout out the Mass, because they will go to seminary to learn. So things like that. By the way, one of the things that illustrates some of the problems here is Pope Paul the Ninth, or Paul the Third, I think it was, is the one who first called the Council of Trent. He had four children by a long-term mistress. Okay, just kind of tell you that's the Pope who called the first council. Just kind of tells you some of the things. And okay, but when it comes to doctrinal things, absolutely no doctrinal change whatsoever. In fact, they said the idea of justification by faith, that a person is justified by trusting in, you know, God, Christ, what Christ did, without works, with no reference to works, is anathema. It is condemned. It is to be accursed. They don't even, they start off with that, okay? So no doctrinal change. On top of that, for a long time in the church, there had been this idea that tradition, unwritten church traditions, the way we do things, is authoritative, but that wasn't really defined. They said at the Council of Trent that Scripture and tradition are on the same level. Okay, you can appeal to tradition in the same way that you would appeal to Scripture. Okay, because they're both authoritative. So the doctrine of the Protestants, which is Scripture alone is authoritative, they are going to specifically disregard that. Okay, and so this is one of the critical issue of the Reformation, right? And they come down on the side of saying tradition and Scripture are basically the same. Also, on the issue of the canon of Scripture, they will say that the 66 books of the Bible plus the Apocrypha, the Old Testament Apocrypha, I think we talked about that way back in a long time ago, ages ago. We talked about the canon process, and the Catholics will come down and say, yes, the Apocrypha is also part of Scripture, whereas the Protestants said, no, it's not. Okay. Latin Vulgate is the official version of the Catholic Church. It's authoritative right up until the modern time, right up into the 20th century. Okay, the Latin Vulgate still essentially is. Okay, and then finally, there will be an index of prohibited books that comes out with the Council of Trent. Meaning, here's a list of books that if you're a good Catholic, you're not going to read those books. Okay, now if you're looking at an old book that's written by a Catholic author, okay, look on the inside. If it's pre-1960s, look for the phrase up there, the very last phrase, nihil obstat. Okay, that means nothing obstructs this. That means that there has been a specific person who is in the office of the index who has examined this book and says, nope, nothing should prohibit a good Catholic from reading this. Nihil obstat, that's what that means. If you're a good Catholic, you can read it. Okay? So, in some of the older books, you'll see that. After Vatican II, they stopped doing that. Okay. So, any questions about the Counter-Reformation or this, what the Catholics were doing during this time?
The Apocrypha was added for what particular reason?
Well, there were on a few of the doctrines, let me see if I can remember this, a few of the doctrines that the Protestants were disagreeing with, there was some vague support for it in the Apocrypha. For example, the doctrine of purgatory. There is, I think it's in the Assumption of Moses, a little phrase that could be interpreted as referring to purgatory, and that people were there and then they would be released from there. Because you can't find the doctrine of purgatory in the New Testament anywhere, or in the Old Testament. But that was one of them. I would have to go back and look and see specifically what some of the other ones are. Can anybody remember? You've been reading the Apocrypha. Somebody's been reading the Apocrypha lately. Yeah. There may be, you know what, I think also there may be some reference in the Apocrypha to praying to saints, people who have gone on before. And that would be one of the reasons.
Yeah, I had heard, and I do remember before I heard this, that one reason that they canonized the Apocrypha was kind of a reaction to Protestants publishing their own Bibles, and then the Catholics were saying, well, you don't have a Bible. You're only have part of it, so we've got the whole thing. And there was also, I think, an understood tradition that the Latin Vulgate translation was inspired. And I struggled to remember before I heard this, but I think it was in some of my reading about this.
Yeah. Well, the second one, I think that sounds accurate to me, or that it's authoritative. I don't know if they would use the word inspired, but it's an authoritative thing. It comes from a church father, Jerome, and he's trustworthy. I'm not sure they would have used the word inspired, but definitely authoritative. It's authoritative for that translation is authoritative. Now, the other one about whether the Apocrypha, that argument would be because Protestants run around saying, you know, you've got the Bible, and they would say, no, you don't have the whole Bible. I'm not sure about that one. I look it up. You know, because, I mean, they didn't want to give any of the Bible to lay people, right? And that was the thing. You could not translate the Bible into German, or they didn't want the average person reading it. I mean, right up until the 20th century, guys, that's the case. You know, it's just that the Bible is too hard to understand for the average person to read it. And they might misunderstand it. So, yeah, Leon.
How did the Protestants that broke away from the Catholic Church recognize the Apocrypha? Was it a separate book like Old Testament, New Testament, Apocrypha?
They would, Luther and those guys just, they said, you know, this is just some good reading, but it's not authoritative. They didn't consider it inspired.
And so they eliminated certain books of the Bible by saying they are the Apocrypha?
No. There is a specific group of writings that from the early days of the church was known as the Apocrypha. Okay? So it wasn't like they decided, oh, we don't like that book, let's put it in the Apocrypha. No, there was a specific group. Okay? And you know, their argument, which I think I agree with, is that the Jews never considered this authoritative scripture. They still don't. Okay? And it was not in the Hebrew manuscripts. You know, it was just in the Greek, the Septuagint, and so forth. So, yeah, the Protestants said, you know, no, it's not the Hebrew, it's not in Hebrew, and it's not authoritative scripture. So, and we talked about way back, I don't know, 2 months ago, when we talked about the canon process, that issue of what to do with the Apocrypha was kind of left open. There was, for a long time, there was a lot of debate about it in the church. I mean, but it didn't get cited like the canonical scriptures did. It was kind of always left over here. But with the Council of Trent, they kind of reached it and kind of really said, no, it is part of scripture. You know, finally. Yes?
Were the Jesuits involved in the world?
They were. Yeah, they came to New France and Spain, New Spain as well. Yeah, they did a lot of missionary work, especially up in Quebec and those areas. Wherever they could go, you know. Yes, they were. And I'm trying to remember. There's a great movie called The Mission. You've seen that? Okay. I really recommend that if you want to understand kind of this thing. I'm trying to remember whether he was a Jesuit or whether he was a...
He was a Jesuit.
He was a Jesuit. Okay. Well, okay. Yeah. Great film in many ways, but it does help you illustrate kind of the monks that went over to the New World. I mean, there were many monks that went to the New World that weren't Jesuits, so we have to make sure there were Benedictines and Franciscans and a whole lot of them, so...
I had a man tell me that the Jesuits were the military of the Pope. Did they do any physical killing?
Good. Was he being literal? They were literally the military, or?
That's what I heard.
Well, they usually are referred to as the shock troops, you know. But I don't think. Yeah, I don't think they were actually wielding the sword, though.
Spiritual warfare.
Yeah, spiritual warfare, and they would just go and. I mean, they go into a town and they just start slamming Protestants and, you know, and debating them. They're very good debaters, you know. And so I thought it was mainly spiritual. Now, that doesn't mean that from time to time somebody couldn't break out fisticuffs or whatever, but...
Because I heard of St. Bartholomew's Massacre in France where they put a lot of Christians in the church and burned it down.
Yeah, but those weren't Jesuits that did that. Those, yeah, they were... Well, that's getting into another... basically, there was within France, there was a long time dispute between Protestants and Catholics. And there were a large number of the nobility in France who had become Calvinist. And they were called the Huguenots. And they also, because they were the nobility, of course, then they were the wielders of power. And so there was kind of a power struggle there around the throne of France. And in 1572, things swayed against the Huguenots at just the right time when they thought that they were kind of, things were getting better with the Catholics and that they were going to coexist. And Catherine de' Medici just decided, no, that we need to get rid of them. And brought, actually, there was a wedding between a Huguenot and a Medici. And all these Huguenots were in town, you know, for the wedding. And then the order was sent out to just go hunt them all down and slaughter them. And they did. And it was thousands and thousands and thousands of Protestants were murdered, massacred in Paris in 1572. And then in the outskirts of France as well. They never really recovered from that, the Huguenots in Spain, in France. But it wasn't the Jesuits who were carrying that out. It was the soldiers of the king and the Duke of Guise and a few other nobles that didn't like the Huguenots. By the way, the Counter-Reformation Pope, when he heard about the massacre of the Protestants, ordered a special mass to be sung in praise to God for the slaughter of the Protestants there on St. Bartholomew's Day. So it was pretty intense, you know. England actually cut off diplomatic relations with France for a little bit over this. They were so mad, you know, Elizabeth, you know. Okay, well let's wrap this up, and I have this one thing that I would talk about if we had time, but we don't have time. Let me take 3 minutes to do this because I think it may be informational. One of the things that we Americans have struggled with ever since the Reformation is the whole issue of church and state. We still have we still debate this today. But coming out of the Reformation, I think there are at least three views that you're going to see in terms of how does the state relate to the church. One is just a continuation of Christendom. Let's just keep going on like we have. In the Catholic Church, that's what they would like to see. A cardinal or a bishop sitting right next to a king and whispering in his ears, and basically they're two sides of the same coin. Now, similar to that would be the Calvinists. People like John Calvin and Martin Bucer and Presbyterians like John Knox and so forth, they would envision that kind of thing as well, where the state, where you live, everybody in a particular geographical region would be on the same page religiously. Okay, if you could do it, that would be a good idea to do it. Right, and so Reformed folks, even though they would technically make a distinction between the church and the state, would say that it's a good thing to try to reform all of society for the glory of God. So if you go to a place that's Calvinist, they usually like to try to reform all of society, not just the church as a separate from the society. So think of the Puritans in New England. I mean, they want to reform all of Massachusetts, not just little pockets of it, right? Okay, so that's maybe basically a continuation of Christendom. The other one is the two cities in cooperation. The two distinct spheres, church and state, but they work together. And this would be the classic Lutheran view, okay? The only problem is Luther had such a very strong view of the authority of the state that at the end of the day it almost looked like the state really ran the church, okay? And that the church really relied heavily upon the state. And so oftentimes Lutherans really do a lot of self-reflection, because when Hitler comes along in the 20th century, he is going to be quoting Luther to get the church to kind of go along with his program of Nazification of Germany. Okay, and because God has ordained the state to do a specific thing, and the church shouldn't try to get in the way of that. Okay, and so Lutherans have struggled with that. But then there's the two cities in opposition, which is the Anabaptist view. The idea that the church and the state really should never be really connected. In fact, I mean, they're two different spheres. And you really, there's not much involvement between one and the other. We talked about that earlier on when we talked about Anabaptism. When it comes to toleration, there's not going to really be a strong sense of toleration across Europe until we get into the 17th century. The concept of toleration that was established in the Peace of Augsburg, when they fought a few wars and they finally decided to stop fighting, was, okay, let's have peace. And the principle is, whatever the religion of the ruler is, that's the religion of the state. And so if you don't like it, just move. Okay? So that's not what we would consider toleration, right? But at least they didn't kill you. They gave you an opportunity to sell your stuff and move away. But whatever the religion of the prince is, that's the religion of the realm. Okay, so then you had Catholic and Protestant regions in Germany kind of alongside one another. And there were some concepts of pluralism, multiple religions kind of existing together, but that's really going to be a later thing when Europeans finally decide, okay, let's try to get along and not kill one another over religion, really after the 17th century, the middle of the, after the religious wars of the 17th century. So, okay, that's my real quick survey of church and state. I want to show you this clip here. This is kind of a lighthearted thing. You know, wake us up here, get us, you know, jiving. I found this a few years ago. It's a it's called the Reformation Polka. And now that we've kind of covered all this stuff, you'll understand a lot of this stuff. But these guys kind of got together and they put together this little ditty. And I guarantee you, you'll be singing it when you go home tonight, I'm sure. If we can get the sound up.
Is this Jim Jack?
What's that?
Is this Jim Jack? Jim Jack video? Jim Jack?
I don't know. What's Jib Jab? This is from a website.
Then I was just a younger man, I studied canon law. Though at first was a challenge, it was just to please my pa. Then came a storm, the lightning struck, I called upon Saint Anne. I shaved my head, I took my vows, and Augustinian. Papal rules, indulgences, and transubstantiation. Speak your mind against them and face excommunication. Nail your theses to the door, let's start a reformation. The papal rules, indulgences, and transubstantiation. When Tetzel came near Wittenberg, St. Peter's prophet soared. So I wrote a little message for the All Saints bulletin board. You cannot purchase merit, but we're justified by grace. Here's 95 more reasons, Brother Tetzel, in your face. Papal bulls, indulgences, and transubstantiation. Speak your mind against them and face excommunication. Nail your theses to the door, let's start a reformation. Papal bulls, indulgences, and transubstantiation. They love my tracts adored by me, all were exemplar. The Pope, however, hauled me up before the Emperor. Are these your books, dear Regent, King Charles, busy man? I will not change my diet, sir, God help me, here I stand. Papal bulls, indulgences, and transubstantiation. Speak your mind against them and face excommunication. Nail your theses to the door, let's start a reformation. With papal bulls, indulgences, and transubstantiation. Frederick took the wise approach, responding to my words. My knight King George is hostage in the kingdom of the birds. Use Brother Martin's model, lift the languages you seek. Stay locked inside a castle with your Hebrew and your Greek. Oh, papal bulls, indulgences, and transubstantiation. Steep your mind against them and face excommunication. Nail your theses to the door, let's start a reformation. The papal bulls, indulgences, and transubstantiation. arrange our signs and concord books together in this place, and spread the word that Catholic is spelled with lowercase. The word remains unfettered when the spirit gets her chance. So come on, Katie, drop your lute and join us in our dance. Papal bulls, indulgences, and transubstantiation. Keep your mind against them and face excommunication. Nail your theses to the door, let's start a reformation. Papal bulls, indulgences, and transubstantiation. Papal bulls, indulgences, and transubstantiation.
Okay. That's more
jungle
music than polka.
Is that not polka?
Yeah.
Okay. Well, that's where we're going to stop this class, and we're going to move on to new things next week. We've got a couple new classes. Dan's going to be doing a textual class over in this room.